We'll call to order the Senate Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for January 31st. Thank you for being here. And on today's agenda, just for transparency and so members know, we'll be covering three bills initially that will that we will hear that are a part of the A4 amendment with to Senate File 1072. And these are bills that were heard and passed in the House that are provisions that we want to put into the Senate omnibus policy bill that we will be working on today. So the first three bills are bills that you will hear now, and you will also hear an overview, a quick overview of them, when I present Senate File 1072. And the first one that we have is Senate File 1347, Senator Newman. If he can get loose from Senator Perry. Senator Newman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senate File 1347 was brought to me by the city attorney of Hutchinson, Mark Savora, who is sitting immediately to my right. And I think it's a pretty straightforward, easy bill for you. And it involves roundabouts. Currently, there is in statute in Minnesota a requirement that motorists signal the intention to make a turn or a change of lane within 100 feet or before their turn. Recently, Minnesota, the Department of Transportation, has been implementing and building roundabouts in the state of Minnesota, and we have a couple of them in Hutchinson. And it turns out that it would appear that it's legally impossible to comply with the statute because the spokes in a roundabout are less than 100 feet apart. And so when Mr. Savora brought this question to me, I did ask Senate counsel to, you know, just give us a little bit of background and advice on this issue. And the letter that I got back from Senate counsel was the following. That first of all, there's no guidance on this particular issue, and none is expected for approximately 3 years. Guidance that has been developed by other agencies is confusing and recommends that driving behaviors that would it would be difficult to teach driving behaviors to various drivers. And in many cases, drivers are finding it challenging to become accustomed to driving in roundabouts, and adding a layer of non-intuitive turn signal instructions would not be helpful and may more importantly, be a safety risk in navigating roundabouts. I can tell you that Mr. Savora has, you know, worked with me on this issue, and in his capacity as the prosecuting attorney for the city of Hutchinson, feels that probably the best way to do to handle this problem is to simply exempt drivers from the compliance with the underlying statute. And that is the reason we brought this bill forward. Mr. Chairman, at this point, I would like to introduce to you Mr. Savora and ask that he may have some comments on the issue of safety and compliance with this law.
Certainly. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Savora. If you'd state your name for the record.
Certainly. My name is Mark, M-A-R-C, Savora, S-E-B-O-R-A. And it's a pleasure to be here today. As the senator mentioned, I asked him to sponsor this bill primarily because of an incident that happened in a DWI prosecution that I was conducting a couple of years ago. The prosecution ended up being dismissed by the judge at an evidentiary hearing for precisely what the senator had mentioned, the inability for the motorist to comply with the 100-foot turning requirement. The roundabout in the city of Hutchinson is constructed in such a way that the spokes are approximately 60, 65 feet apart, and therefore the person couldn't signal their turn 100 feet before their intended turning motion. Another thing that was brought up in the judge's memorandum in the DWI dismissal was the judge's concern for safety at roundabouts. And what I gathered from that was roundabouts, although they are becoming more and more commonplace in the state of Minnesota, they still are somewhat confusing to people, especially if they're not familiar with them. There's indecision as far as entering the roundabout, indecision about when I should be signaling, when I shouldn't be signaling. Do I signal after the last bulk I passed? Do I signal 3/4 of the way through the roundabout? So it just makes it very difficult from both an enforceability standpoint and a safety standpoint for drivers to be complying with that provision of the statute. Considering that roundabouts are designed, and I'm not going to try to pretend to be a highway engineer, but there is only a right-hand turning motion available to motorists in a roundabout. So people are going to know that people are going to be exiting to the right sooner or later. And I just think that having the signaling requirement just makes it harder for motorists to navigate through the roundabout.
Senator Newman, have we seen any instances out there at all where law enforcement is actually using this as a trap, if you will, or an opportunity, I should say, probably rather than a trap, to ticket individuals, anything other than?
Mr. Chairman, I am not personally aware of any such instances, but I don't know if Mr. Sabora is or not.
Mr. Sabora?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not to read too much into the judge's decision in my DWI case, but that certainly was the intimation in the judge's decision dismissing my case against this motorist, was that the police officers were using the failure to signal the exit to the roundabout as the basis for stops late at night when DWIs might be occurring.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify either for or against the bill? Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Howe, I guess we do have a question. Senator Ryan?
Oh, defer to the vice chair, of course.
I was just going to move that we.
All right. Mr. Chair, I don't know. I don't expect either of the testifiers to know this, but somebody from MnDOT might. How many roundabouts do we have in the state?
You know, Mr. Chairman. I did try to do some research on that, and the latest figures that I got were from 2006, and at that time there were approximately 20 roundabouts in the state of Minnesota. I know it has increased. Hutchinson now is building its third one in that city alone. I know Waconia has two, and I believe there's one near Cologne. Both of those cities are in Carver County. So because of their safety component, they are being used more readily now.
Yeah, very, very, very much a traffic calming
right
effect. So have we, Mr. Chair, have we heard anything from State Patrol or law enforcement concerns? If we do have it's a growing trend, certainly. Do we anticipate any enforcement issues as they become more prevalent?
Senator Reinert, I've opened the opportunity for the departments to come and testify on this. And
Mr. Chair, you haven't had any contact?
I haven't.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
In an attempt to respond to Senator Reinhart's question a little bit, I would tell you that, you know, I drafted and dropped this bill last year. And to date, I have not been contacted by anybody in law enforcement.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment first. I think we probably still need to do more work on it. To Senator Reinhart's point, you know, we're going to have more and more of these, and we probably do need some signal of intention when people enter the roundabouts. I don't know if there's a discussion that we could make this a secondary offense or something, that it wouldn't be used as a, you know, a justification for just pulling somebody over random. But we probably need to continue to do more work on this. But I certainly, Mr. Chair, will move the Senate File 1347 be laid over for possible inclusion in the transportation omnibus bill.
Senator Howe has moved that Senate File 1347 be recommended to pass and held over for inclusion in the Senate Omnibus Transportation Bill. All those in favor, Senator Doble.
It's all right. So, Mr. Chair, I know that you called for testifiers, but could I specifically ask if anyone from Public Safety is here? And I mean, this is a significant public safety question, I guess.
I see Major Earhart is in the office,
If we have any sort of
room.
An opinion or a lack thereof, this is a...
Welcome to the committee, Major.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Earhart. I'm a major with the State Patrol. Just historically, I was contacted by research, Senate research, and asked this question about signaling and roundabouts. And, you know, the existing roundabouts in Minnesota aren't located on too many of the state trunk highways in Minnesota, so we don't have a lot of opportunity to patrolling in those areas where they've been installed. I do have one in my own community, and to be honest with you, I have not noticed a lot of issues with signaling or not signaling or managing the roundabout by drivers. That's about as much background as I can give you, but I'm certainly willing to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you, Major. Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Well, I'll just echo Senator Howe's statement that we just need to consider. I don't know how I feel. I just would like to know what the evidence is that this is or isn't makes us more or less safer. It's fine. You know, I just it's a safety concern, and
sure.
We should have some evidence that it doesn't affect us or does.
Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Newman.
Yeah, if I may at least try to answer the questions of Senator Howe and Senator Dibble. In my mind, the issue is we have a statute that requires people to signal 100 feet before the turn, and it is impossible to accomplish that within a roundabout. That is what really got my attention on this bill. Does it need future work in the future? Perhaps, and we can certainly talk about it in the future. But as of right now, we have got a law in the books that people cannot comply with. And it seems to me the right thing to do is put folks in a position where they're not violating law that they have no way to comply with.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Any other questions? Senator Howell renews his motion that Senate File 347 be laid over for inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Next up is Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senate File 1356.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for such short notice here. I bring before you today Senate File 1356, which pertains to a variance for seaplane base in a small lake in Elbow Lake, which is in my western part of my district, on Lake. I'm going to pronounce this the Scandinavian way, not Fleckefjord. It's Fleckefjord. Being I'm a Scandinavian, it's legal for me to do that, so I just did it. Anyhow, it's an interesting sign when you drive by it, you kind of go, wow, what is all that, you know, what are all those letters, what do they mean? But with me today is Paul Brutenlag, chair of the Elbow Lake Airport Board, who testified over in the House last year. This bill was actually discussed in the House last year and passed over there. Simply running out of time last year, we weren't able to address it. But it just pertains to allowing an airport, and he will get into the actual specifics of it. And I think what I'll do is I'll turn it directly over to him and have him explain the bill in its entirety, and so everybody understands it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. And Mr. Brutenlag, if you would introduce yourself and welcome to
the
committee.
Hello, Paul Brutenlag, and it's P-A-U-L, and then Brutenlag is Bravo, or B-R-U-T-L-A-G. My address is Wendell, Minnesota, which is adjacent to Elbow Lake. This is a Unfortunately, it's a necessary, but it's an important issue. And we have worked closely with DOT and the aeronautics section of DOT over the last couple of years in trying to get a seaplane base designated for Elba Lake. And part of that is for business reasons, and I'll go a little bit more into that. But I do want to say that I, just from a sort of a chuckles perspective, I fly from multi-engine aircraft through hot air balloons, and when I have, from an attorney perspective, I do get a lot of comments that one of the reasons I fly hot air balloons is I don't need to pay for gas to buy hot air. So that's...
I think we'd agree with that.
I just wanted to mention, I don't want to take too much of boring time, if you will, but I would like to briefly reference the statutes and the rules, because that's part of the key issues that we're dealing with. And in Minnesota Statutes 360.018, Subdivision 6, and I'm not going to read them all, but I just wanted the brief parts. Licensing airport or other air navigational facilities, all proposed airports, restricted landing areas, and other air navigation facilities shall be first licensed by the commissioner before they or any of them shall be used to operate. And under the next, there's the next provision, the Declaration of Purpose, and that's 360.011. And that is the Declaration of Purpose. It is hereby declared that the purpose of Section 360.001 is to further the public interest and the aeronautical progress by providing for the protection and promotion of safety in aeronautics. And that's important. And we agree with that, and we agree with the DOT on that. And that's one of the issues that and why we're here. And in the applicable rules, and I'm just going to reference quickly a part of Rule 800 or 88,000.1700, the public seaplane base licensing, subdivision 4/requirements. We have very limited statute that's applicable, but there's a fair amount of rules that are applicable. And of this section, it basically under subdivision 5 where it says size, the body of water shall have a minimum usable length of at least 1 mile, and shall be of sufficient width and depth to permit the safe operation of aircraft on the surface. That's the issue, is our lake is slightly less than 1 mile. And I'll explain that a little bit further. And then under Rule 8800.1500, this is why people love attorneys, we get to read all this stuff, the waiver of requirements, licensing denial, and this is a key. In any case where it is determined that the public interest and safety will not be adversely affected, the commissioner may waive any of the requirements stated in the rules that I've just referenced, subject to such conditions or limitations as may be necessary. And I want to emphasize that we're perfectly willing to have any restrictions or applicable thereof applied to our designation. One of the issues that's very applicable, and one of the reasons it's necessary for us to be here, the DOT is perplexed, I think, with following the statutes, but specifically following the rules. But yet, in Minnesota, and I'm going to reference, and here's the official airport directory, and those of us that fly use this. In the back, the purple or the blue pages, replica of water, there are 14 designated seaplane bases in the state of Minnesota. Here's the key. Of those, six of those designations are less than a mile. That's the issue that we're dealing with, and that's why in Deerwood is one, Grand Marais is one, Hibbing is one, International Falls is one, Tower is one, Waubun is one. And the particular one that's a specific interest is Hibbing. And that's about a 2,500-foot length seaplane lane designation. And if they can have 2,500 feet, we've got excellent lack of, obstacles and so forth. And that's one of the reasons why we're here. And one of the other reasons that we're here is that we have a young airport FBO operator. And he used to be with Columbia Helicopter. And he was the chief mechanic for keeping the big twin rotors in the air in the whole civilian market. That's a huge issue. Joe LaRue is his name, and Joe decided that he wanted to come back to Minnesota, and he wanted to start up, and he's a young guy. He's in his 30s, and that makes me feel proud because I'm more than double that. He wanted to come back and start an FBO business for General Aviation in Minnesota. And there's getting to be, unfortunately, those of us that were involved in FBOs, unfortunately, for whatever reason, we're dying and not continuing to do that. Joe wants to continue to grow in the FBO business. And I've got, I just want to designate a little bit, just a little bit, to give an example of what's happening. And his airplane maintenance is like in 2008, where there was 308 aircraft maintenances done. Last year, there was 418. And I've got the graphs along. And like in 08, there was basically 80 total airplanes that came in. And then about 15 of those were seaplanes. And this last year now, there were basically 145, and about 25 of those were seaplanes. And seaplanes can continue to use Lake or Fleckefjord Lake, even though an airplane is allowed to land on public waters in Minnesota. But what Joe can't do, because of this, he cannot advertise his base or his FBO as having a seaplane base. He cannot do that. And that is a plus. He's got excellent little blurbs of advertisement going around the country. And I mean, these are some of them. Like, I just wanted to give you an example. He can't designate any of these advertisements as being seaplane-based because we're not designated as a, quote-unquote, legal authorized seaplane base. And his coverage is expanding. He's going from War Road to Des Moines, Iowa, to the Twin Cities, to Rapid City. And in the seaplane base, he's going from Walker to the Twin Cities, Fargo, Appleton. And that's why, all of you, I appreciate the time, and I think that it's necessary to have this looked at, and because, I guess you're getting the attorney part of me out again, because there is already in existence, and there has been since the rules went in, there has been designated seaplane bases that are shorter than a mile, and that's the purpose of this bill, and that's what I'm asking about. So I've got maps along today. One of them sets forth, we had our own measurements done by our county engineer in the highway department. I've got that data and stuff along that shows our width of being just over a mile, or just slightly less than a mile, 5,280 feet. So that's it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brutlag. Any questions from the committee? Senator DeCryve.
Thank you, Senator Gimsey, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, Senator Engelbrechtson, if you have landed and taken off on this lake to demonstrate the safety of this.
Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And no, I have not, but would be willing to certainly give that a try. I've been by there many, many times, but no, I have not. However, I've landed in a lot less, I suppose, landing strip, if you will, pieces of water in Canada with bush pilots several times, and that's an experience in itself. For those of you that have not done that, you should really do that. You'll learn to appreciate a longer runway. But no, I have not. Can I just
put that one? Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, sir. Your name again?
Paul Brutlag.
Mr. Brutlag. So I'm just looking. I looked in my AOPA directory, and looks like the runway at Elbow Lake at the municipal airport is 3,401 feet.
Correct.
By 60 feet of width. And I'm just sort of pulled it up on Google Map and looking at the lake, and it looks like you've got this Elbow Lake Park kind of jutting out a little bit into the lake. So I mean, what length do you think you'd get? I'm assuming your FBO must be located on the east end of the lake, closer to the airport?
On the west end of the lake.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. On the west end of the lake. Okay. So is that closer to town or closer to the airport?
One of the things that's unique about the airport in Elba Lake is that the airport is right on the edge of the lake.
That, yeah.
And that works good for the maintenance perspective because the seaplanes come in. And we have seaplanes coming in from the whole area of Minnesota now.
Right.
They land and then they can either taxi in or be pulled right up to the FBO sure. hangar.
If you've been to Duluth, that's where I'm from. You probably are familiar with Sky Harbor. So
yes.
It's a dual purpose. We have a hard surface runway and then
yes.
we have the seaplane base as well. So it sounds, akin. Of course, we have St. Louis Bay miles that you can land in. So, again, Mr. Chair, my question for the testifier would be, what length do you think you would have on the lake?
Mr. Brutlock.
And I'm just taking out from our 5,074 feet. We would have to take off slightly to accommodate for the 1-to-20 ratio at the ends.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd be in that, and there's been numbers that we've talked about with DOT, we'd be in that, you know, that 4,000, between 4,000 and 5,000 foot range.
Senator Reiner.
Mr. Chair, does that take into account that what looks to be a narrows on the lake where there's this point
the
that comes
narrows out? Width would have to take the long way, and that would be 300 feet or 300 feet in length and in width, so that there'd be a plenty of width there. And I'll add to that that part of what we're getting this, and they're willing to come in and provide information or testimony if you would like, the seaplane group in Minnesota is willing to address the issue too, that they think that it's very applicably comparatively safe. And mm-hmm. I'm familiar with your airport, and I love it, and that's a little bit of the reason that I think it's a lot of similarity.
Right. Well, Senator Ryan. I park my plane over at Superior, but okay. If you're up, let me know. Mr. Chair, I was wondering if we have any testimony from Transportation, the Aeronautics and Aviation Division?
We do, Senator Reinhart.
Thank you.
We will invite up Chris Roy from MnDOT.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Roy, for welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Roy. I'm the office director for the Office of Aeronautics at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to this issue. What I wanted to do was, first of all, confirm much of what Paul said is correct, and a fair amount of it we have no issue with. Where we do have some issues are a couple of ones that have not yet been mentioned, at least in detail. And the first one is the geometry of the lake, and I apologize without the AV here. What's happening is the lake from one end to the other is 5,000 feet in length, and we don't dispute that. What we do have issue at is the nature of the lake. It has two peninsulas, one that comes out here and another one that comes out here, which creates a landing lane of only 310 feet wide from shore to shore. So therefore, what happens is you essentially have a runway of defined nature on the lake, and it's very tight through there. So it does present some problems should there be anyone out on the lake, although I understand that doesn't happen at all or certainly not very often. But the other thing that it does is it doesn't align up well with the prevailing wind conditions. Prevailing wind, you typically want to land and take off into the wind on a lake. Many of the other lakes that were mentioned that have seaplane bases are more circular in nature, so you're able to land up your takeoff and landing in such a way that you can get maximum length on that. In this particular case, your maximum length is here, and that's your only option. Otherwise, you're doing something here where you have much less than 5,000 feet in length. The other part that wasn't mentioned was in the same rule, 8800.177 subdivision 5 that Paul had referenced, he did not talk about the glide slopes that are required at each end. So in addition to having a mile usable landing area on the lake, you need to have a 20-to-1 slope off of each end. When we factor in those 20-to-1 slopes off of the elevations that are actually in place here, we only have a landing length of 3,974 feet, or roughly 4,000 feet in length. Furthermore, there's another requirement that says that seaplane in particular, can be within 100 feet of elevation. They have to be at least 100 feet higher than any structure there. So when you factor in that additional 100 feet plus the 20-to-1 tapers, you actually end up with less than zero landing length on this lake. Now, all of those rules come into play when you're talking about a public seaplane base. In the same set of rules, a little different section, there's something called a private seaplane base. And the private seaplane base has similar sorts of rules other than the length is not spelled out to be at least 1 mile in length. We've gone through this, and we feel that this is an appropriate and licensable action that we have offered continuously to Elba Lake, and yet they have refused to take us up on that. There's one distinction that is required between a public seaplane base and a private seaplane base, and that is with a private seaplane base, you must obtain prior permission of the operator of that seaplane base before landing there. We feel that that's an appropriate action, one that can be discussed with the pilot and the seaplane base operator. They can talk about the wind condition of the day. They can talk about if others are planning on using that so that you don't have two planes, you know, trying to operate in the same narrow 310 feet of width. There's many things that can be discussed in that forced communication if it's licensed as a private seaplane base. The other exception would be, generally speaking, in order to have commercial operations at a seaplane base, you do need to be licensed as public. But we would work with the proposed FBO so that we could create some language that would work on all of his advertising. And what we would say is that prior permission must be granted prior to landing on this lake in order to receive the services that are going to be offered through this FBO. We feel that that's a very workable solution and one that fits within the existing guidelines and the existing rules, and that'd be the one that the department advocates for, given all of the safety considerations of the existing geometry on the lake itself here at Elba Lake.
Senator Reinert.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Roy, as a restricted access seaplane base, it would show up on maps and have all the comm frequencies indicated and things like that, correct?
Mr. Roy?
Chair and Senator, yes, what we would, in the directory itself, currently we do only do the publicly licensed seaplane bases, but we could make an exception to this, and in this case, put it in there. Many of the charts, it would show up there as a private seaplane base, and we do have some ability to include that if the operator would want it there. I presume they would. We could do that on the state chart as well.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chairman, if we've finished all of the testimony, I'd like to make the motion. I'd like to move Senate File 1356 be laid over for possible inclusion into the Omnibus Transportation Bill.
Any discussion?
Excuse me?
Senator Sherman?
I'm sorry. I should have gotten my hand up earlier, and I don't know if it's okay to ask one more question during this
Certainly.
Time.
Certainly. Go ahead, Senator Sherman.
Because there is an alternative being offered, could you speak to why the alternative being offered is not one that you're willing to accept as an amendment to the proposal?
Mr. Brutlock?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that question, and there's a number of issues, and I'll use Hibbing. And I said earlier that we're willing to accept any, you know, appropriate restrictions to be applicable. Hibbing has 2,500 feet, and they have a number of restrictions, just as what Chris has already described, and we're willing to do that with a designated airport. The issue is that there is no current statute and there is no current rule setting forth a special private designation, and it cannot be used for advertising, and it cannot be used for qualifying, if you will, for that kind of legal FAA/airport activity. And that's one of the reasons that we feel it's important for us to be able to also have the same designations that other airports, seaplane bases, sea lanes in this state with less distance than we have.
Senator Reiner?
Mr. Chair, at the risk of being repetitive, let's walk through that again, because, I mean, it seems to me as a pilot that the restricted private base is the route to go. I mean, what I worry about is opening up the map and looking at and it's telling me this is a public seaplane base, and that means to me that it has a landing strip that's predominant wind favorable. I mean, it just tells me a whole bunch of things, which in this case don't all seem to be consistent. Where a restricted one, I know I've got to call ahead and have somebody tell me about it. You know, it's really going to be 3,000 plus feet. It's really going to be, you know, it's the one direction, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it sounds, so I guess let's just walk through that. I mean, because that to me would seem to be the route to go, and unless I can get my head around that, I probably can't be supportive of this, and I really don't like not being supportive of aviation things, so.
Well, I appreciate that. Our wind direction is basically west, mm-hmm. and in our part of the state, that's quite there are we have runways in our part of the state that are primarily west.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it isn't that's a secondary issue from a issue of what I call landing function.
Mm-hmm.
The issues of restrictions, I'm being redundant. If we were the exception rather than the rule for the designated of seaplane base slash landing lanes,
mm-hmm.
But we're not. And that's why I raised the issues of the six seaplane bases that already have less than that length. And there's and from a flying perspective, and I will say this, although I'm not certified with seaplane base, I have flown, and the flying that I've done with that has primarily been up in Canada, and we've landed and taken off with a 90-horse champ.
Yeah, same here.
twice inside a mile. And if it... I hope I'm not being redundant. Please, Mr. Chair, tell me to stop.
Please continue, Mr. Brutlog.
if there's going to be, and this is where you shouldn't get me going, if there's going to be a change in the rules, change in the statutes, and the applicability and the designation of seaplane bases in Minnesota, so that I'm going to borrow Chris's, we've talked about this, the private seaplane designation, so that that can be used for advertising, mm-hmm. so that it qualifies for advertising. That's a big economic slash business interest for our town of Elba Lake and for our fixed base operator.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, and I appreciate Chris's sensitivity to that, I hope you don't mind if I tap you on the shoulder. We've been working together.
You see him sliding away.
We've been talking about this. And I appreciate I won't call it quite a declaration, but his statement that he'd like to probably see this, but we don't have any of that at this point. And that's why I think that, and I just want to say that at this point, I'm really pleased with the approval of the motion, because it does give Elba Lake then the same credibility, designated credibility, as other seaplane bases slash lanes already have in this state.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Reinert.
Two follow-ups, Mr. Chair. I'll keep them both brief, if you would allow me. Mr. Roy, response? I mean, FBO is a challenging business, and I can understand that perspective, but I also understand the department's responsibility to assure some consistency across. And, again, my concern is pulling out the map and thinking, well, here are the public ones. They all mean something. Here are private. I know I need to find out more information. But I think Mr. Brutlog has some valid points as well.
Mr. Roy.
Commissioner, Senator. We feel much the same way. In circumstances, many of the other seaplane bases are on more circular lakes, so you have some differing options depending upon the wind coverage. The other thing that happens, particularly at Hibbing seaplane base, is there is no other structures around the lake itself. It is in a relatively remote area, a distance away from town. So the 100 feet above structures would not necessarily apply.
Mm-hmm.
So each one of the situations is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. In our directory, there are several there that are at 5,000 foot in length. And I think in the case of Elba Lake, if this lake was simply a better geometry, more of a circular geometry, at 5,000 feet, I think it would start to make sense. But given that there's really only one landing lane of any length, it does raise some questions. And I think where the questions come in, when it's publicly licensed seaplane base, there is an expectation of a certain quality being able to come in and out of this seaplane base. And that would be pilots of varying abilities, planes of differing sizes, different loads, a wide variety. And it's probably true that some airplanes you can land and take off twice inside of a mile, but there are other ones that would really be challenged and mm-hmm. a bit struggling with that. So we do have some concern over that, and we feel that the private license and forcing that communication to take place is the appropriate course of action, and feel that that would probably be best in this scenario here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Roy. And, I guess just to put in a little input as a pilot, private pilot myself, we fly into unimproved airports all the time. I think there is a lot of discretion and responsibility on the part of the pilot to ensure that they have sufficient landing and takeoff space, wind direction. All of those are things that you do in your pre-flight planning. And in the connection with the FBO and making sure that everything is right before you take off and before you land. So it is a bit of a difference between this type of an operation, and safety-wise, I understand, but the lake isn't heavily used for recreational purposes. It's also the responsibility of the pilot to fly over and ensure that they are recognized and that the route is clear of any other recreational aspects in the way. So, pilots recognize their responsibility too in entering and leaving those types of situations. So, I think that can somewhat mitigate some of the risk and just the additional training that you have to be able to land and take off on water. So just my two cents worth, if you will, as a private pilot. And Mr. Brutluck?
Just to reaffirm that, I mean, we as pilots, even though we're going to an FAA-certified airport, we have to make that same analysis. And we've all made the analysis, no, it doesn't fit us to land.
Right.
Number two, I want to tap him on the shoulder. The significant obstacles in the end, on the one end, off to the one side, we have the airport, and he said our beacon tower is too high, and we're perfectly willing to take that down and move that. On the other end, there is a house or two, but only a house or two, but that's significantly across the state highway of 54 and across what used to be the old sewage lagoons, and that's significant distance away. It's not a stated part of town, if you will, or a significant residential part of town. And we do have our city council's act in behalf of this, and I do have minutes and so forth along with that. They're in full support of this also.
Thank you for that, Mr. Brutluck. Senator Lorie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just going to look at the mechanics of the second and last sentence here, too. It says that the commissioner may establish conditions or limitations as may be necessary, which you keep talking about, like
right.
willingness to take that down.
Right.
But then it goes on to say, except that they can't. Except that the variance must be provided, notwithstanding the requirements of any law or rule to the contrary. So, I mean, they couldn't actually impose any law or rule to force you to do anything under my read of that second sentence. And so that's actually a problem mechanically for me in the language here.
Mr. Brutluck?
We can certainly have that language corrected and the language, but on the other side of that, I think what that language, now I'll get the lawyers talking. I think what that language says is that it gives the commissioner the authority to provide for limitations.
Except that it doesn't.
We can correct that because we want it to have so the commissioner can provide for limitations. And one of the things that we've said and agreed with on that we do not want to have any student pilot activity or flight training activity in that kind.
Mm-hmm. Senator Cruz is up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm kind of astounded as how many aviation experts we have on the committee. So that's pretty impressive. But I'm excited about this bill because of its business potential. So I would really like to see us move this forward. And from what I'm hearing, it's a lot of these security concerns. So I'm wondering, Mr. Brutluck, if you could, for those of us who aren't aviation experts, don't understand how these safety procedures work and in general operations, could you please very briefly, if this bill were to be moved forward and passed into law, what would some of those security processes be? How does that work?
The security / restrictive processes, Senator Krause?
Mm-hmm.
We'd have no problem, and I'll suggest today that we have limitations that aren't any different than the ones that are already in place at Hibbing. I mean, I'm going that far. We have already agreed that we should not let any kind of training or student activity, and I'm saying student activity, student training with an aircraft, take place there. Those are the kind of special conditions, because I think that meets a number of public safety issues, and particularly because of length, but just as particularly because of with the seasoned seaplane pilots, they aren't bothered at all by the two points that come in from each side. If they were right across from each other, so you actually had physically a 300-foot limit, that'd be different. But these two points are a considerable distance apart. So from a geographic perspective or a geometric perspective, you have 300 feet when you draw the straight lines. But from a landing perspective, all you got to do is change your angle a little bit, depending on the wind and conditions. You got a lot more than 300 feet. So we're willing to work on and implement and include those kinds of specific restrictions.
Follow-up, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a real quick follow-up. You know, with the private designation, we were kind of talking about some of that communication. I guess I would specifically like to get to that. Without that designation, does any of that communication take place just out of habit, or what are some of those requirements?
Mr. Brulock.
And I'm not, even though I'm going to say this, but I'm not borrowing any other pilots' pre-flight and landing requests. Virtually all of us use 22.9 or 22.8, whichever is applicable, on landing and announcing the landing and looking over the landing. If there's any questions, I mean, to this day, when I fly a Skymaster, you guys can laugh at that one. But, I mean, I call ahead even before I take off. I mean, even though I'm talking with Center and Approach Control and the FAA on flight service, I'm still calling ahead, and I think the same thing would be applicable here, that particularly if the language is in there, such as Hibbing, people are still going to call ahead because they need to know.
Thank you.
Senator Reiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cruz, I'm sure either the chair or myself would be happy to take you flying. I've got a bigger lake to look at. Again, so. Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment.
Certainly.
I think we can, at least I can find support for this if we – and I see both of our committee folks writing over there, so maybe they're working on this already. But it seems to me if we would, and I'm not an attorney for the record, so I don't want to get in the middle of this, but if we just put a period after necessary, the commissioner may establish conditions or limitations as may be necessary, period. First sentence says you're going to grant the variance. But I do want to have consideration for the department's concerns over heights and restrictions, so... If smarter legal people want to massage those words, I'm okay with that. But I'd like to offer an amendment to that.
What line?
To that extension.
Well, Senator Reiner, to look for not being an attorney, I think you're awful close to what our Senate counsel has here. Ms. Berzovsky?
Mr. Chair and members, the only other provision that I had included in my suggestion was on 1.7, delete may and insert shall.
Yeah, and then that would be with a period after necessary.
And then 1.8, delete everything after necessary. 1.9, delete everything to the period.
I'd offer that amendment, Mr. Chair.
That's what we're saying. Senator Reinert offers the verbal amendment to insert shall on line 1.7. Strike the word may and insert shall. Eliminate the comma on 1.8 after necessary and insert a period and strike all of the remaining language on 1.8 and 1.9.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Howell.
Mr. Chair, I think procedurally doesn't Senator Cruz have to remove his motion that he made to or table it, pull it back so we can make this amendment?
No, he doesn't. We haven't voted.
There's a friendly amendment.
We haven't amended anything until we have to vote on
it. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if MnDOT, if this satisfies MnDOT sufficiently.
Chair, Senator.
Mr. Roy.
I think my first preference would still be that we do have rules that would license it and it would fall under for a private seaplane base. That would be my preference. If it were passed, we'd certainly work with the operator in the community to see what we can do. To come to agreeable terms on what those conditions would be. I think they'd be very close to what Paul has pointed out for on Hibbing. There might be, you know, some additional language contained within their license about not operating a flight school or seaplane flight school in particular on this particular lake. So we would have to make sure that we understand what those conditions are, and, you know, there could be something here that would work out. However, if we do have rules that would license this appropriately and it's a private seaplane base, that seems to make more sense to me, but we'll certainly be able to make do with either.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate that being able to work with
similar to what you obviously have done with the Hibbing situation, which is not anywhere close to the length here, talking 2,500. And I understand there's a difference between round lake and long lakes, extending lakes. But that plus throwing in the common sense that both of you pilots have talked about here, that you're going to make a flyover to make sure this is safe before you land. If you don't, you're kind of foolish. I don't think anybody has to explain that. But that amendment is certainly fine with us. So.
Okay. Does everybody do all members understand the amendment? Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chairman, do you need me to remove my motion before we can make that amendment?
No, Senator Cruz. Okay. Thank you. On the Reinhart amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Now, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to renew my motion and move that Senate File 1356 be laid on the table for possible inclusion into the Omnibus Transportation Bill.
As amended.
As amended.
Senator Cruz moves that Senate File 1356 recommended to pass and laid over for possible, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, may I interrupt just once? Those of you that fly and or want to drive, please fly into Elba Lake.
We're open for business.
A shameless plug.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next up is Senator Perry. Senator Perry, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm here before you today on what's called the Dimler Bill, which was first enacted back in 1987. And what it really does is it governs which speeding violations are recorded on a motorist driver's record that is maintained by the Department of Public Safety. You'll see in this House File number 537, in Section 1, requires a uniform traffic ticket to provide a space to indicate whether the violator's speed in the 60 miles an hour per hour zone exceeded 70 miles per hour. Current law requires the ticket to indicate whether the speed in a 60 mile per hour zone exceeded 65 miles per hour. So as you take a look at Section 2, this would prohibit the Department of Public Safety from recording on a driving record a speeding violation in a 60 miles per hour zone that does not exceed 70 miles per hour. And as you go back, this to me, when I first this was first brought to me, it appears on my side more of a uniformity change, because right now, if you don't know, if a citation, if you're doing 55, if you're doing, say, 59 in a 55, that is not recorded on your driving record. We give that 10 mile per hour grace there where it doesn't. It's still against the law. You're still going to get a ticket. And so this bill takes that, if you're in a 60 mile an hour zone, it gives you that same courtesy as what was given to those that are driving in the 55. Does not change anything. If you want to take the chance and drive at 67 miles an hour in a 60 mile an hour zone, you're taking your chance. But it just again provides the same courtesy in this zone as it does in the 55. I know there's a couple of testifiers that would like to come forth and testify, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions from the committee? It's outrageous. You should have just gotten a ticket. I understand that there are MnDOT, Office of Traffic Safety and Technology, is here, and also somebody from DPS. They're not readily coming up, so maybe we don't. Okay, there we are. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is, Donna Berger. I'm the director of the Office of Traffic Safety with the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify on this bill this afternoon. For the record, our office does have concerns, safety concerns, with this bill. Illegal or unsafe speed is the leading contributing factor in fatal crashes. History has told us that when speeds are higher, fatalities increase. The consequences of excessive speed include the greater potential for loss of the vehicle control, increased stopping time and distance, and increases the crash severity when a crash does occur. According to NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, a crash on a road with a speed limit of 65 miles per hour or greater is more than twice as likely to result in a fatality than on a crash with a speed limit of 45 or 50. Speed is the greatest crash factor for our younger drivers, those who are already at higher risk because of their inexperience and have a tendency to drive aggressively. Over the last three-year period of 2008 to 2010 in Minnesota, illegal or unsafe speed was a contributing factor in 266 fatal crashes, resulting in 296 deaths. And during that same time frame, 65% of those speed-related crashes occurred on rural roads, where people tend to think they're safer. And just my final point is this change has the potential to mask the problem of repeat offenders, the high-risk drivers, as I mentioned, the aggressive drivers that tend to be in serious crashes. That's all I really have to say. I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Berger. Any questions? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question either to the witness or to the chief author. What is the experience of other states in this sort of provision? Do we know what other states do in this regard? And what is the effect on their driver safety records and the like?
Senator Perry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I couldn't answer that. I haven't checked into the other states. I was just looking at what was brought to me. So.
It seems to me that what we're talking about here are roads that are posted at a higher speed limit anyhow, at 60 mile an hour, not at the 55, which is more the rural roads. The 60, I think, tends to be more the interregional corridor type of roads that are probably a little better maintained, if you will, or not quite so prone to accidents as some of, as you will, the country roads, but again, recognizing that these are roads that are posted at a higher speed limit. Just there is that 10-mile difference on a posted 55-mile-an-hour road that we already don't put on people's records, the up to 10 miles per hour over. In order for these roads to be posted higher, they must be deemed safer. And so it just would seem to me that it would only be fair that that same requirement based off of the posting of the road would seem appropriate. But that's my editorial comment, I guess, on that part. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Perry, I don't know if this is for you or for the expertise of the committee, but I know there are places in Minnesota right now that if you drive over the speed limit, you can pay money to not get it on your record. So Hennepin County, I believe, does that on Highway 94. But will this remove that ability, where it'll just automatically not count?
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, it sounds like you're talking about the administrative fines, which some cities have grabbed hold of. It's obviously a contention with some folks in the state because they'd like to have those fines instead of them staying in their own local locale. But this has nothing to do with that at all.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the 60-mile-an-hour limit, are there any two-lane roads that this would apply to, or would this just be divided highways or four-lane roads? Because it...
Do you know that? Ms. Berger?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would leave that to MnDOT. It would be better to answer that question. They'll be up next to testify.
Well, Senator Howe, in my district, Highway 71 runs right through it, and Highway 71 is posted at 60 miles an hour. It's a two-lane road. And also portions of Highway 23, which run through my district and across the state of Minnesota, are at 60 mile an hour also, a two-lane road. So
Thank you.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think we should realize that both MnDOT and the local road authorities work together to set the speed limits on the roads.
Right. So. And again, this doesn't keep law enforcement from writing the ticket itself and collecting the fine. It just levels the playing field, if you will, for as far as what goes on the record and what doesn't, what's reflected. So, any other questions? Senator Perry, would you like to move your bill?
Was there one more testifier?
You are correct. Sorry. Major Earhart?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Earhart, and I'm here on behalf of the State Patrol. Just briefly, we also have a safety concern with this legislation. And as we look at highway safety, one of the most significant variables in highway safety is voluntary compliance. And we see that this legislation would possibly erode voluntary compliance if you have repeat offenders that continually speed and are cited, and it doesn't get posted to their driving record, then virtually they have no driving record because it doesn't get posted to that record. And we do see repeat offenders that continually speed and Dimmler, if you want to call it that, is used by those motorists to keep those violations off their record. We certainly understand the isolated incident where somebody might get cited, and there's a concern about having that going on their record, but our true concern is with those repeat offenders, and then voluntary compliance starts to erode, and then we have more and more problems on the highway. And, of course, we all realize in recent years that our crash numbers and seriousness of the crashes, that trend is trending down. There's less and less fatals year by year, and there's a lot of highway safety partners involved in that effort, and we truly would like to see that repeat offenders have those convictions posted to their records. So thank you.
Thank you, Major Earhart. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. Is there discretion on the part of an officer who stops me for speeding? And I've gone in a 55, I've gone 66 or 7 or more to look up my record and see that I don't have any speeding violations, to indicate on the ticket a different speed than is recorded on his monitor or her monitor.
Major Earhart?
Maybe you can't answer that question. I should maybe not put you in that position, but I'm wondering if there's discretion on a historical record of somebody that you're talking about where you need to keep a sense of a repeat offender. And you'd like to have some information that demonstrates a pattern that will go away if we pass this legislation, but allows you for the person that maybe Senator Perry is concerned about that I'd like to give a break to for one time but doesn't want to really. I don't think Senator Perry wants to give a break to a person who's consistently violating the law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, from my experience, yes, individual officers do have that discretion to make a decision about what action they really want to take out there. And each department has their own policies and procedures that their officers are required to follow. But I can tell you from my experience when after 32 years of service in this agency, investigating crashes and making traffic stops, that folks that are repeat offenders, they're the ones you see more often than not involved in, as the previous testifier said, aggressive driving, serious crashes. And I think those are elements that you see in the crash statistics that
tend to bear out, that folks that continually speed, eventually they're running on borrowed time and they will be involved in an incident.
May I follow up with one more
Senator
question?
Sherman,
I'm trying to remember. I confessed on the floor of the Senate last year when we were discussing something about this that I can be among those that would benefit from something like this, so I may have to withhold my vote as a conflict of interest. But but I wondered, there are 70-mile-an-hour areas for driving in the state of Minnesota. Are there areas that are posted that 70 miles an hour is an allowable speed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, there are.
And so it's possible the next request is that if that 10-mile-an-hour break occurs, then I could be driving my 80 miles an hour consistently and not have a record of that. No. Is that true? No. Is that a true statement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, this legislation specifically deals with 55-mile-an-hour and 60-mile-an-hour speeding zones. But historically, the original legislation that Senator Perry mentioned dealt only with 55-mile-an-hour speeding zones. And, of course, that was back when we all were living with the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, which was federally mandated. And, of course, things have changed since then.
Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Scherr.
I understand what this legislation is about, but I'm thinking that it is the creep, isn't it? The next speed limit level is 70, that if you applied the same principle to 70 as you are now to 65 as we did to 55, that it – at what point are we saying we don't want – we want to put the hammer down on the violation of the law? So that's a concern to me, Senator Perry, that I'm – I'm certain that this – I understand that I'm going to be a benefactor, believe me, of what you're proposing. So that so that if I choose not to support it, it's because I understand the concern of the department.
Senator Lohr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess maybe Senator Sherrin suggesting we even go retroactive with this. I'm not entirely certain, but no, I say that tongue in cheek. But honestly, you know, as one who's concerned about – keeping my record clean as well, and I'm just wondering what the concern about the driving record in my mind is more about the insurance rates that I'll be having to pay, particularly with a handful of teenagers out there that are, you know, one of them totaled my car over the holidays and all, but that's always a concern. But it's kind of the insurance rates, and maybe, you know, there's these safety concerns about being able for the officers to identify these repeat offenders. Maybe it'd be more of a commerce issue to take up and say that it couldn't be used as rating on a first occurrence or something like that. I'm just thinking out loud here, trying to, and maybe I'm wrong about the motivation behind this law, but it might just be another way to fix some of the issues that drivers have for that one time slip up. And I don't want to see, you know, my rates go through the roof just because I sped once. But I would want to be answerable for repeat behavior. So maybe a commerce approach might be an alternative to consider. Just out there for food for thought.
Well, Senator Lohr, I think you maybe put your finger on part of the pulse of this bill. So, you know. Senator Dibble, did you have a comment?
But I'll wait until after the final test bar. Thanks.
Any other questions? Senator Perry.
Just a couple of things, and Senator Sherrin, I agree with you. I guess as a former law enforcement officer, I understand what the major is saying. In today's world, it's insurance is part of it, I know. But in today's world, I truly believe, as it was when I was handing out the speeding tickets, it's not about the point. It's about the fine and constantly, because you do catch them. This is about vehicles and a law back in 1986 with the way we were driving back then, the way the speed limits were. We felt that it was appropriate at that time to give that it's a 9-mile-an-hour break because when you hit that 10th mile, it goes on your record. And you're right. Every officer, I don't care what department they're on, uses their own discretion on whether they write a ticket or not. That officer could come across somebody that could be 15 miles over. But based on the situation, the area, the road, the attitude of the person being stopped, the whole circumstances, which we are highly trained to know everything that's going on around us, we make that decision on whether or not that person has the opportunity to prove themselves. And this is what this is just doing. It's saying, hey, we have this in law. We're giving that 9-mile break before it goes on the record. And we have a 60-mile-an-hour speed zone that we would like to see the same thing done. I don't think I've heard anyone talk anything about, nor do I believe they will, because when you get over 70 miles an hour, I just don't see that happening. But
we have Peter Bushin with MnDOT. If you would introduce yourself to the committee, please.
My name is Peter Buchan. I'm the assistant director of the or the assistant state traffic engineer from MnDOT. There's some cards being passed around that I'll be referring to. MnDOT also does not support this bill for reasons very similar to what public safety expressed. We're concerned that as the public becomes more aware of the limits on reporting speeding violations, that they'll become more complacent about speeding, and speeds will increase on our rural roadways, and therefore we will see an increase in fatal crashes. You may be aware of the Toward Zero Death effort that MnDOT, Public Safety, and the Department of Health are involved in. That's been a very successful effort, and we've seen significant reductions in our fatalities. On the card that has the side of it that has the graphs, you'll see the reduction on the top of the card. The blue line is Minnesota, and you'll see that since 2003, fatalities have decreased from 655 to this year. It's now 365. So that's a significant decline in fatalities that we're seeing on our roadways, and we think some of that is in part due to the Toward Zero Death efforts that we've been working on with our partners. As Donna referred to, fatalities related to aggressive driving and speed have increased 21%, or currently account for 21% of the total fatal crashes on our roadways. The percentage is higher on rural roadways, on local roads, which make up a significant percent of the state's total roads. On the opposite side of the card, you'll see the number of miles of each jurisdiction within the system that makes up the roadway. So there's a significant amount of rural roads that do not belong to the state under the state's jurisdiction. So for that reason, we are concerned that this would result in an increase and a trend upward in fatalities if it was passed.
Hey, thank you for your testimony. Senator Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, I think that's why Senator Perry's bringing this bill forward, is to help himself out here. So, I just wanted to speak to the issue of discretion, and I'm wondering if there might not be more tickets issued if this provision goes through than less tickets issued. And I think the officer has a lot of discretionary power. I mean, the officer decides whether an individual enters our criminal justice system or not. And I'm just wondering if there's not this flexibility in the officer's mind that, this is going to be a permanent part of this individual's driving record if I issue this ticket or if I give them a warning. If the officer knows this isn't going to affect the driving record, would fines not increase over that? That I can issue this ticket, and there's a monetary expense. So I guess I'd just like to hear an answer, Mr. Chair, on that. Maybe the State Patrol might be able to better answer that question.
Senator Perry, Mr. Bushin.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Howell, I don't know if there's an answer to that. What we're trying to do here is provide the same uniformity in two speed zones as we are already offering. I, for one, well, actually, I asked a couple of people if they knew what the Dimmler law was and what it meant. They had no clue. Turned around and asked them, do you know if you get a ticket, it goes on your record? And everybody that I talked to said yes. That's what this is not going to change the way I believe officers are going to do their duty and then either enforce or warn somebody who might be speeding. I just, they have too much to do the way it is now. You know, when I go back to when I was running radar in the old, and the major might remember these days, the old Operation 55 days. We set, because we wanted to keep them at 55, I remember we set our radars at 60, but we were all on rural roads. And it was about the fine, more so than anything going on your record. It was about the monetary amount that they have to pay out. And I think that's what people look at. If we're 8 miles over, I'm going to pay X amount out. I think it's just a standard. I'm not even sure what the fine is for 8, 9, and 10 miles over, but I do know it goes up. So we're just providing that. Do we want to provide that same opportunity in the 60-mile-an-hour zone as we do in the 55? That's the decision we're making here today. Do we want it to go on their record, or do we not? And I think that's really where we're at.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To Senator Perry's point, I mean, we're also making a decision about, you know, the practical outcome and effect of this provision if it were passed. And I think, you know, it just stands to reason that more people will speed and will, you know, we'll see these downward trend lines on the fatalities in Minnesota not go down as quickly or maybe level out or even go up. And, you know, I understand when it comes to making decisions about speed limits, you know, we could get a whole lot of extra safety if we lowered every speed limit in the entire state to 20 miles an hour. I mean, this is a job that takes some discernment and some risk analysis and some trade-offs. And, you know, we've figured out kind of where that equilibrium is in terms of speed limits, and we listen closely to our public safety experts and our engineers, and we consider roadway design, et cetera. But, you know, what we're simply inviting folks to do is, you know, not, you know, understand that they're not going to realize the full consequence of their speeding if they get caught, and some measure of folks will drive faster as a result. That will be the outcome of what happens. And more people will get hurt or worse as a function, as a consequence. So, you know, I don't think it is a well-advised step to take. I mean, to Senator Sharon's point, you know, borrowing from Senator Perry's language, we'll extend the same courtesy then to the 70-mile-per-hour zones and invite folks to go up to 80 miles an hour, still get a ticket but not understand the full consequence. I think Senator Lori's suggestion might have been a good one if we really want to get to, you know, addressing an issue where folks might have slipped up and that full consequence maybe isn't warranted in terms of their record and their subsequent insurance rates. You know, your driving record follows you around and has implications for all kinds of things. But this is, feels good, freedom-loving folks, let people drive faster, that's great. But this job is a job of discernment and the public good and public safety and trying to find those balances. And this is stepping back from some of the consequences that occur from driving too fast in areas where a particular speed limit has been posted. So I think it's not a good idea. I respect the counsel of our public safety and our transportation professionals. I suspect that if this is included in the omnibus policy bill, it might create a little tension as it moves its way towards the other branch of government. I don't want to talk too much about that because we are the legislature. But I think we should have an understanding of that as we proceed if we do include this. Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call vote on this motion.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call.
Senator Gimson.
Prepare for that.
Has there been a motion?
No. Senator Scher?
There has not yet been a motion.
No. When there is a motion, Mr. Chair.
When there's a motion. Thank you. May I ask a question?
I very much appreciate it. Just a moment, Senator Scher. I very much appreciate Senator Dibble's comments about, you know, the possibility, if you will, of increased speeds and speeds moving up and the cost of that to the individual. But I also remember over the last 4 or 5 years about the discussions about reducing or eliminating penalties from certain individuals on, you know, in this body, simply because of the increased cost to them. And in a lot of cases, the increased insurance costs from a first-time offense like this can be significant. And that cost, in the vein of what I've heard in the past from others in this body, disproportionately affects people with less means than what we have. So, you know, I've heard you argue probably both sides of this issue as far as the costs go on this. But, again, the speed limit stays the same. The ticketing stays the same. It's just whether somebody, a 21-year-old or a 20-year-old that gets stopped at 71 miles per hour or ticketed at 71, bears the brunt of the next 5 years of their insurance rates going up has an impact, too. So, you know, I've heard you understand what I'm saying. We've heard both sides of that argument, Senator Dibble. But,
well, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Dibble?
I think Senator Laurie was touching on that very subject in his idea, which I think is an idea worth exploring. This is significantly different. This doesn't address that. This is simply, you know, kind of lifting that, you know, lifting the you know, the record, no matter how many times, no matter what the age, you know, if that's what we're trying to get to, we can address that more specifically and more precisely, and I might support a proposal like that. I'd like to see it fleshed out and consider it, but this is kind of, you know, this is a significant change. And Mr. Chair, I just also wanted to say that, you know, the Towards Zero Death initiative is something that we should be really proud of.
Oh,
as a committee, as a legislature, as a state. You know, it's a significant accomplishment, and it's been brought about by the hard work of community-based organizations, individuals, advocates, ourselves, resources that we've put, changes that we've made in policy, you know, the collaboration among professionals, all kinds of professionals across multiple agencies using evidence and really taking significant steps. I think we would, you know, this would be a step away from that and breaking faith, and I think be somewhat discouraging to those folks and, you know, a lot of folks who have worked hard towards creating graphs like this. And so I'd like to keep the faith with all the folks who have done so much and accomplished so much in the Towards Zero Deaths initiative. We, you know, I go all over the country in these different legislative conferences, and sometimes I get to brag about Towards Zero Deaths. Sometimes I'm hearing about it from other folks in other states talking about the Minnesota Towards Zero Deaths initiative and what a model it is. And this would be a significant departure and, I think, discouraging to those folks and contrary to all of that work over these many years.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator Dibble. But even in your comments just now, you offer up both alternatives. You just said that maybe this is a discussion for the Commerce Committee and talking about the insurance issues, but you don't want to address that here. And you said that you might even be able to support that. So
it is
what it is. Nobody wants to turn away from Towards Zero Deaths and the advantages and the good things that have happened under that. But I guess I'm not quite convinced that that's going to happen. Senator Scher.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a couple of questions, if I may. Senator Perry, are you open to the idea that Senator Lori is suggesting here that to achieve the break that allows liability insurance not to, or your automobile insurance to go up, that if it's possible within the department to know that somebody has violated the speed limit at 60 miles an hour without recording it in a way that it affects insurance, would that meet the essential objective that you're trying to achieve? Because if it is, if they can do that, if the department can do that, and that meets your objective, it is possible, we've done this in the past, have asked an author to take a bill to step back away and work the language a little bit and then come back with language that would accomplish what Senator Lori is suggesting here. So if that meets your objective and the department has the capacity to do that, I would like to support that, and I'd have difficulty supporting the language that is as it is now. Maybe you have know the votes and you've counted them here already. I don't know, and that's unnecessary. But if that does accomplish your goal and it really would bring a full support from the committee, I would encourage you to consider doing that. Thank you for that.
Senator Chair.
That's a question for Senator Perry.
It is a creep.
Thank you, Senator Perry. Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Lori brings up a point. I think it's a whole different issue that we have to go down. One thing, I appreciate the fact that Senator Dibble wants to paint the picture that by allowing this to go through, we're going to create havoc with zero deaths. Where he comes up with that idea, I'm not quite sure. If this was such a serious concern, do you not think that the Department of Public Safety would have been here trying to get rid of the Dimmler law? Would there not have been a survey showing us that there is a real problem by giving a person a break, as has been happening for the last how many years, since 1986? I believe what's happening here is we're trying to create a problem that does not exist. People don't inherently want to speed. Occasionally, they do. And when they get caught, for the most part, in my career, I had found that they learned. What we're doing here is giving that person that break. But Senator Sharon, what I can tell you is that, you know, this is a discussion on how the insurance affects and the speeds and the insurance work. I think even last year in my last session and the session before, we had comments about the undue pressure it puts on some people without the means, as the chair brought up. That's something that I think probably down the road needs to be looked at. But I think we should also then look at how this and how we would prove that, or what kind of survey would be done to prove that if a person gets a break and it doesn't go on their insurance, how do we even survey that? How do we even find out if there is an issue, if that's what we're concerned about, giving that 9-mile-an-hour break before it goes on their record? They're still going to get a fine, still going to get a ticket, doesn't change any speed laws. But it offers that opportunity. I mean, we could start talking about all of the other things that have happened since 1986. Safer cars. Seatbelt laws to keep people safe. So I have a hard time buying in that by offering this one, if you want to call it a benefit, hey, this time, I can't buy into that. And so, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would still move that House File 573 be approved.
Senator Perry, if I can, I think what we will do, we've had a very good and deliberate discussion about this bill this afternoon, but in the essence of time, we like to start on time, we like to finish on time. I think what we'll do is carry this bill over to the next committee hearing, and people have had a chance to mill and think about it, and, you know,
potentially work on some of these ideas that have been brought up. Why don't we just hold this over till Thursday and take it up along with at that time we'll take up Senator Wolf's Senate File 992 and also the omnibus bill and try to get that completed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That the session of the hearing is adjourned.